Tuesday night edition of the pod. Kawhi Leonard returned tonight, playing his first game of the season. We'll talk about how he looked against Dallas, although they ended up losing in that game. Fun overtime tilt between Minnesota and Philly. And a really enjoyable game also in overtime between the Knicks and Lakers. That one we'll spend some extensive time on. We're brought to you today by Helix Sleep. HelixSleep.com/capspace will get you $50 off your personalized mattress. Let's begin with talking about what you saw from Kawhi Leonard in that game against Dallas, Danny.
First things first, it was just nice to see him on the court again. That, you know, he was an MVP caliber player last year. You know, he was included in that conversation and had not played since that spectacular first half against the Warriors in game one of the Western Conference Finals. And then, of course, he sprained his ankle twice and then the quad tendinopathy. He didn't look like 100% Kawhi Leonard. You know, I think that was in some ways the most apparent thing out there. His jump shot looked good, but he wasn't moving like Kawhi Leonard, and that didn't particularly concern me, though it was a reminder of probably where he was for a while before this. If they were willing to let him play in, I don't know where you want to put this, like 75, 60% or something like that in terms of his full mobility, where he was before that, but it was still nice to see him out there.
Yeah, it was definitely did not look like him on either end. He got winded, to be sure, and there was a time when defensively, even, you know, as he's usually very active, he had his hands on his knees in the third quarter. Did get up 12 shots in just 16 minutes, had 13 points, shot 6 of 12 from the field, hit a 3. We last saw him pretty early on in the third quarter, and they never brought him back in crunch time, which is a strategy that I actually kind of like, because, you know, at the end of games in particular, guys are going to be going really hard. And Leonard, this was kind of a view into what he's going to look like, you know, 7 years from now, I thought. I mean, he really looked pretty old out there, but with his great strength, was still able to maneuver into position and shoot over guys in the post or pulling up for mid-range after using his shoulder to get good position in the lane. But yeah, I mean, just watching him, was not running at full speed, was not at full intensity defensively. I thought it was impressive, given his limitations, that he actually scored as well as he did. But it's clear to me that he has some way to go before he gets back to being the player that we have come to expect.
Yeah, he was San Antonio's number 3 scorer, and he played 16 minutes and was still, you know, not that. It was pretty impressive. And he had a couple of, like, I mean, I thought his jump shot form looked great. He had that one where he had a 3 in transition. He had a kind of a pull up at another point, I think it was on Harrison Barnes. And that's good. You know, that the fact that he was getting, you know, maybe not as much rise as he usually gets, but getting a fair amount of it, I thought that was nice. And just the guile, like, it was another testament. You have this sometimes when players are coming back from injury, like you see some of the underlying skill because they can't use the other elements that make them so great. And the fact that he was able to get that position on Harrison Barnes in particular, that he kind of started with an ISO and just got to his shoulder and got that shot in the paint. And so we didn't see, especially I thought offensively, you know, because he has that jump shot, you can go to that. Whereas on defense, he had a couple like rebounds where he just tipped the ball because he's Kawhi Leonard and has amazing hands. But you can't get that kind of stuff on a possession by possession basis just because defense functions so differently.
Yeah, and also worth noting, the Mavs broadcast said it looked like he actually asked out of the game in the third quarter, but it would be typical of the Spurs that he wouldn't play more than about 15 minutes as he did, and then he went to the locker room presumably to get treatment. We haven't heard anything about an injury afterwards.
I thought I heard something that it might not have been all what was planned, but that it was that they weren't worried about anything. There was no special concern. He just went back, and we're seeing this a little bit more often now in the league, just to get extra attention because there are certain things they can do back there that they can't do just on the sideline. So I wasn't concerned. If they're not concerned about it, I'm not going to be concerned about it.
Yeah. As for the game itself, I watched most of the second half. 95-89, Dallas took it despite only 1 of 8 shooting from Dirk Nowitzki and 1 of 9 shooting from Devin Harris. Everyone else played well. JJ Barea continuing just what has statistically been one of the higher scoring seasons of his career, 16.6 of 11 for him, hit a couple of big threes in the third quarter as Dallas pulled out to the lead that they would eventually maintain in this one. Dwight Powell has continued to impress of late. He had 12 and 14 with 4 offensive rebounds in only 17 minutes as they went to a more mobile approach. And they were largely smaller than the Spurs, and that led to the Spurs trying a lot of post-ups and also just missing a lot of three-pointers as well. So, and Manu Ginobili, who'd had some nice games lately, played 27 minutes, but he only had 5 points. A lot of guys, Danny Green was 1 out of 6. LaMarcus struggled a little bit as well. They posted him up a lot, but he wasn't able to score with the efficiency that we've seen from him. Rudy Gay, really the only Spur who did well. Bryn Forbes had a really rough game. He had one stretch where he took a really tough floater, then he bricked a wide open three off the backboard, and then tried to draw a foul and got a three-pointer blocked like in like three straight possessions. But he's been playing a lot, so it's an ugly loss for the Spurs, something that can happen. I mean, this Mavericks team, Rick Carlisle knows how to play the Spurs as well as everyone, and they kind of got lulled into Carlisle ball, shall we say, and the Spurs actually took more three-pointers than they normally would, but as mentioned, only 25%, 7 out of 28.
And so now we'll get to see Kawhi Leonard in a couple of different circumstances. They have a nice little rest here. And yeah, they do have road games back to back. Like, they're road games consecutively, they're on this kind of trip. But it's Phoenix, Dallas, Houston, so they could sleep in their own beds if they want to. Like, they don't have to travel and deal with all those rigors if they don't want to. They can go home for a couple days. And then they have that. Then they play Dallas again, actually. Their next league pass game is against Dallas. It's the third time I think they'll play this year. So it's going to be a process. Like, with Kawhi, I don't think anybody expected him to be 100%, but also that the Spurs will be judicious about this. I trust them more than I trust any other franchise to be patient with this and understand that the long game is what's important. And they were 19-8 without Kawhi Leonard, so they know that they don't have to rely on him as heavily. And remember, they're incorporating Danny Green, who missed a couple games due to injury and all this other stuff. So they're going to figure it out. There was nothing in today's game that made me think, oh man, it's going to be any sort of trouble for the Spurs. It was just Dallas had played a nice game. They missed some shots they normally make, and they're getting all these guys back.
All right, much more to get to here, but first, this from the mattress that I sleep on, Helix Sleep. And if you want to get started with them, you can get $50 off at helixsleep.com/capspace. That URL, easy to remember. We talk about it all the time on the program. A couple things stand out about Helix Sleep. Number one is their 2 to 3 minute questionnaire that allows you to actually customize your sleep experience in terms of temperature, in terms of firmness. If you and your significant other can't agree on how you want it, you can actually get it split down the middle as well. And we have two of them now. We have one in the guest room, got another one for the master bedroom. And ever since I got it, I've been getting the best sleep of my life. It's the one that we originally got is 2 years old now and still is good as new. I tried another one size fits all mattress delivery company that you may know from sponsoring other podcasts, and it wasn't as good. I actually ended up returning it because it just wasn't for me. One size fits all, I apparently don't fit into all. So the way it works, you could have a Helix Sleep custom mattress at your door in a week with free shipping, and then you get to hold on to it for 100 nights. If you don't love it, they will pick it up and refund you in full. So once again, the way to get started with them, helixsleep.com/capspace. That's helixsleep.com/capspace. Let them know that you came from us. Let's hit a little news here first, just to kind of change things up before we get into the gamers. And the place to start really is in some of the biggest news that I think is actually interesting to talk about. I generally eschew the balls and all the LeVar Ball crap, but this is interesting to me because LaMelo is actually like a real prospect. LiAngelo, not so much. But they now are going to play in January in Lithuania, a small team called Prinu Vytautas, which is in a town of only 10,000 people. They have like a 2,000 seat gym and like not at all considered an upper echelon Lithuanian league team. These guys probably can't even play for the A team. They might play for the B team, but certainly could use the publicity apparently. And so it'll be very interesting to see because the coach is known as a really strict coach.
Who doesn't speak English.
Yes, yes. And the biggest thing that struck me here about this was that I don't think that LeVar made the right decision. Like, he's coupling together LiAngelo and LaMelo, and LaMelo is like a real prospect. He's the number 7 high school kid. He's, I think, is in his junior year right now, and he actually dropped out of high school to go and play here. And, you know, I can't imagine they're getting that much money. But LiAngelo is considered to not really be a prospect, as Woj has made very clear with his many tweets telling us about how he doesn't approve of these tactics. And I agree. I mean, it doesn't sound like that great, but interesting to see Woj going in on them like this on Twitter. In any event, I think LaMelo is someone who maybe could have gone somewhere that would have made a little bit more sense and could have actually been in a team's development system for 2 or 3 years and possibly could have actually contributed on some level. But LiAngelo, maybe not. And also, I think last thing here, Danny, I know I've droned on here, but you remember what happened with Terrence Ferguson, where the Adelaide 36ers basically took him on, and then it was almost just like they're both able to print money. Like they paid him, you know, whatever it was, a decent salary, and then they were able to recoup that by his NBA buyout. And so teams that, from a financial perspective, could potentially appeal to teams. But if now it's like, oh, you got to deal with LiAngelo as well, and like you're going to have to play him and have him around when, you know, he's not really going to help on the floor and isn't an NBA prospect, you're really limiting what LaMelo can do.
It reminds me of, and I fortunately never had to deal with this because my sister is great, but those people who just kind of like, you saddle one kid with another just because it makes things easier. And it happened, there are times this happens in politics, it happens in sports, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's really unfortunate for LaMelo because it narrowed the options. And the other part of it that you didn't mention is LiAngelo is the worst player and is also the one with baggage because of what happened in China. And so I don't know if the teams there would have treated LaMelo differently. He was, of course, not involved in the incident at all. So whether they would have said, hey, we don't want to deal with any of you, or whether it would have been, hey, he wasn't there, it's not his fault, anything like that, I think they would have sold tickets for him. So but I think putting them together definitely took China off the market, and whether it had already happened or not, I don't know. And I mean, if that narrows your window to teams like this, that's going to be with coaches that can't speak English, it's going to be a problem. And I have broadly avoided LaVar Ball as a topic because I just don't find that much interesting about it, and because from a basketball perspective, and because
I think this is interesting just because
I'm getting into
right?
it
right yeah
but so and also because Lonzo is by all accounts a really good kid, you know, has a good head on his shoulders, and so I always have trouble when people try to make other things the story when the fact that he's raising a good kid is an important part of this. But this is a decision that materially affects somebody who is of relevance to our jobs, and that makes it matter. And so I think it's a bad decision. Of course, that is not condemning it. We've been wrong before, we'll be wrong again. But I think that he did one of his sons a disservice here, and I hope it doesn't have any lingering effects. You know, talent almost always wins out when it comes to the NBA, but these things do matter.
Yeah, we'll see. Maybe it'll actually work out okay. It does seem there has to be more. Like, it looks so bad on the surface that there has to be more in terms of assurances than what we've already heard. I mean,
I think there's an opt out a month into this contract or something like that. Like, there's some weird. I think I've heard things like that. But contract reporting is hard enough. Contract reporting on European lower league contracts is even harder.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens. And I do appreciate anyone who says, hey, you know what, this stupid amateur system in the U.S., we're going to try and get around that and actually make some money early on. It seems like LaMelo was starting to get to the point where he might have had some eligibility issues and stuff like that if he had continued on the path of going to UCLA and staying in high school. But there is, you could say that the U.S. system for the top guys actually does develop people pretty well, and we'll see whether that in fact happens in Lithuania. But, you know, we'll be monitoring this here and there. What else we got here, Dane?
Let's start this with Cody Zeller. We talked about it on the podcast yesterday, but now we have a much more specific idea. Woj originally reported that Zeller is going to have meniscus repair in his left knee. He is expected to miss 6 weeks. That is
That is incorrect. I mean, I know that's what Woj's tweet said, but
that's a trim, right? 6 weeks is a trim.
No, repair is like when you actually like, I mean, that he probably was just wasn't thinking about it, but like the repair is the one that takes like 4 to 6 months. That's the one that like that Derrick Rose had, that Westbrook had, that ended in 2013. But so it, it's actually just the trim. So it's this is the one that's 6 to 8 weeks. I know the tweet actually said.
Yeah, so the timeline is correct. The terminology was incorrect.
Yeah, and as I always say on these, I'll take the over in terms of how long he's going to be out. You know, it usually ends up being 2 months, and especially for Zeller, who has not really been a incredibly quick healer and also has had repeated issues with his knees in the past. And amazingly, Charlotte won in a blowout at OKC, just blew him out of the water in the third quarter. And we'll actually see Charlotte tomorrow against Houston on the Tour NBA show, where I would not expect them to be as competitive. But I mean, still at 10 and 16, it was Zeller out for this long. There could be issues. And then Marcus Morris, per Shams Charania, he's expected to miss extended time. We noted that he was supposed to be reevaluated on Tuesday once they returned to Boston. And our prediction was, with this thing lingering, that, you know, maybe there could be surgery or he may have to be shut down. We still don't have any knowledge there other than just a sore knee. But if anybody can withstand Morris being out, I mean, I think they're really going to need him in the playoffs because Ojale isn't really ready as an offensive player. And they're going to need someone who can attack switches and ISO as well. And we've seen, like, what the few games that Morris has been right this year, that he's had a positive effect. So hopefully he can get back at least, you know, and back into the swing of things before the playoffs. But for now, during the regular season, Boston should be fine. They actually got worked by Chicago when Kyrie was out with a quad contusion, like their whole team was out, including Morris on Monday.
A little bit of a Mavericks corner on this. Dennis Smith is going to not play on the upcoming road trips. That I think it's three games that they're going on. And so it still doesn't sound like it's something, you know, big, long-term, serious, but it is worth noting. And the more serious one is that we still don't have a timetable.
Yeah, but by the way, the hip injury for Smith, Eddie Sefko's column actually said it's an adductor, so more of a groin issue.
Groin thing.
So that's good that it's not, you know, something like more structural with the hip, at least for Smith. But a little worrying for Smith that, you know, he's kind of had a few of these nagging injuries, especially as with the high flyer that he is and the fact that he tore the ACL in high school.
And just being, I think he has taken Joel Embiid's place as the scariest faller in the league as well.
Yes.
And then the other one, his intended backcourt mate, Seth Curry, still doesn't have a timetable, just keeps getting setbacks. There's a piece that's sitting in my to-read tab about really going through it, but that has to be frustrating for him, you know, in a contract year. As much as we lose sight of that, he's in a contract year. It was expected to be a big part of this Mavericks team, and now we're 2 months into the season, and we still don't know when he's going to come back.
Yeah, and he had severe issues with that fibula when he was at Duke, and, you know, he said in an interview that, you know, he'll start up activity and then experience soreness and keep having to back off. So it really has been frustrating, and it may get to the point, you know, he's had very slow improvement per the MRIs that he's been getting. And so maybe a surgical option will have to be pursued there if things don't start picking up. Continuing with the lower leg injuries, Tony Allen will miss 3 to 4 weeks with what sounds like a stress fracture of his fibula, probably the non-displaced variety there. He'd been on the fringes of New Orleans rotation, and also very difficult to play him at the same time with Rondo. Yesterday, we speculated on where Derek Jones Jr. ended up. The answer was right back where he was before with the Northern Arizona Suns, but he will be just signing a contract with them to stay there. That's the system that he's been in. Still a surprise to me that he was not, in fact, claimed.
Yeah, it was a surprise because he had a very team-friendly contract. It didn't even guarantee for this season for another month, and then it had more on top of that. I would have considered that for teams that had space. Like, even, let's say, the Pacers, it would have been a pretty clean flyer for them to just try him out for a month and see if he's any good, and then let him go. If not, and you can go to 10-day contracts or whatever the heck you want to do. Danilo Gallinari had another glute injury, not a flute injury, as Dan Wojcicki originally tweeted and amused me to no end. But that was the only amusement with this because, of course, Gallinari is an important part of the Clippers' success, particularly without Blake Griffin there. And this doesn't look to be nearly as severe as the last one, but he'll be out a couple games.
Yeah, the distinction, I think, is that the glute was a pulled muscle the last time, and this, he took a bit of a hard fall, but Rivers saying it'll be a couple of games, but hopefully it won't be longer than that. He didn't seem as concerned about it. John Wall set to return on Wednesday per David Aldridge against the Grizzlies in DC. And Tony Jones reporting that George Hill, you recall, he tweeted a bunch of angry emojis after a Kings loss, and when Scott Perry was there, supposedly the vets were, and now Scott Perry, of course, is with the Knicks. Supposedly the vets were told, like, oh yeah, we're really going to try and compete for the playoffs. Well, you know, I don't buy it there. Like, if number one, we all knew that they were going to be really bad. I mean, if you thought that they were going to be good, like, you're just not looking at the roster. And they had eight guys on rookie scale contracts, and so it always seemed like sort of more of a veteran shepherding exercise. And it's also revisionist history because George Hill had absolutely nobody else who is remotely willing to pay him the type of money that the Kings did at the time that he signed. We were shocked that he ended up there because it looked like his market had dried up even further than it eventually had.
Yeah, he didn't turn down the reported extension offer from the Utah Jazz to sign that offer from the Kings. And we don't do sound drops on this show, but if we had one, a tiny violin would be very appropriate here, because when you're signing with the Sacramento Kings, it doesn't matter what somebody tells you. With this roster, you couldn't have expected that they would be actually competing. You could say the word try all you want. I think they intended to compete this year. They just weren't good. And so if that was the way they went into it, then somebody made a mistake. I don't know who it was, but somebody did.
I mean, they had already drafted De'Aaron Fox. Like, what do you expect? And Jones, and I completely agree. We were critical of them for a while. Just like, you know, you're not bringing in another point guard. I mean, maybe you can play those guys together, but Fox needs to have the ball in his hands. And it's maybe the issue is that, you know, Hill isn't playing as much. He thought he would just play more and the kids would play less, and that they've kind of gone with just like more of a development, like tanking type of strategy. And then Hill actually gave an interview with Sean Cunningham out of Sacramento, sort of saying, hey, you know, I knew realize it's about development now and blah, blah, which I'm sure was nicely assisted by King's PR. This would be an interesting one for you, Danny, especially given you recently wrote a book on Golden State Warriors history. Any thoughts on the retirement of Matt Barnes and his career? I mean, we don't need a long soliloquy, I guess, but a few things. He's an interesting character.
Yeah, I mean, he is a role player to be certain, who has just made an interesting impact on the league. You can think back to his relationship with Kobe Bryant and just all the trials and tribulations there. I mean, his years all over the league, being a part of two incredibly memorable Warriors teams as a part of that, kind of bookending his career. And Barnes should be remembered also as one of those real success stories of a guy that came out of nowhere. I mean, he was not on the NBA's real, he went to UCLA, of course, but he wasn't drafted or anything like that. Don Nelson actually was basically found him. And I think Baron Davis advocated, it's funny, this is in my book, but I don't remember it well enough. I think Baron Davis advocated for him to get a tryout, and then he got a tryout, and then he did really well, and, you know, made a long career out of it, made a lot of money, was on part of championship teams and the We Believe team, of course. And so, yeah, I think it's an interesting legacy, and he helped make this a more interesting league, and I am thankful to people who did that.
Yeah, always a polarizing figure between teammates and opponents, and his inability to keep up his temper, but, you know, certainly on that We Believe team played a very interesting role. One of the first teams that really just played guys at the four who normally it would have been threes, and then it probably had his best years with the Clippers. I mean, it was interesting, you mentioned the money, and obviously by any person's standards, he made a lot of money, but I think he basically was on like 1 year minimum contracts for maybe like the first like 8 years of his career, and then he finally ended up with the Clippers and signed like a 3-year deal for the mini mid-level at like $3 million a year, and actually ended up quite underpaid by that, and managed to play well into his mid-30s, and then ended up getting a huge contract from the Kings, who are, of course, still paying him now, a 2-year, $6 million deal, and they waived him, I'm sorry, 2-year, $12 million deal, and they waived him, you know, 2/3 of the way into the first year of that, and that's how he ended up on the Warriors last season.
I want to correct one thing. I said NBA championship teams. I knew it was one. I was just talking about that his competitive teams, because while he did play on the Lakers, he did not play on their championship teams, and I believe he hadn't played in NBA finals before the one he played on as a Warrior last year.
Sam Amick reporting, and, you know, I'm always interested to hear what people say like this, but that the Rockets are considered by rival executives to have a decent chance of signing LeBron. And yeah, you know, that's nice, but if LeBron James is going to demand a max contract of starting about $35 million per season, it would be, I mean, yeah, maybe they could move Ryan Anderson, maybe they could move Eric Gordon, you know, maybe they could move PJ Tucker, but you basically cannot have James Harden and Chris Paul and LeBron James all making the max, and then you've also got Trevor Ariza, who they want to bring back as well. They would presumably want to bring back Clint Capella. He's got a $7 million cap hold, and so it would take some massive, massive salary cap gymnastics. I mean, for instance, Harden is due $30 million next year. If you take out Anderson and Gordon and Paul's cap hold and Ariza, you still only have $43 million in space. Do you think you're going to fit LeBron and Chris Paul both into $43 million in space? And that's after you've gotten rid of Ryan Anderson and Eric Gordon and Trevor Ariza. Good luck, Daryl. I mean, maybe if LeBron really wants to take less, but he has been very adamant, of course, about getting the most that he can in his career, vowing never again after he took less in Miami.
I think that if LeBron and CP are going to play together, it's probably not going to be in Houston. It would be somewhere else. But, you know, we've seen before that if there's a will, there's a way. It's just that there doesn't seem to be a whole heck of a lot of way here.
All right, let's talk Lakers and Knicks. I really enjoyed this game on a number of levels. It started off with Kristaps Porzingis just burning the Knicks in the post as the Lakers took a quick lead, and then Porzingis got them back into it, you know, tying the game at 13. Porzingis ended up with 37 points in 40 minutes, but that really changed the strategy because he was burning guys one-on-one, whoever was guarding him, and so... and also getting off in pick and pop type of plays. So they decided what they're going to do was put Brandon Ingram on whoever the point guard was. And then any play involving Porzingis, they would just switch and then Ingram would be on Porzingis. I thought he actually did an okay job on KP. Or if they had to switch someone else on there, like, you know, Alonzo Ball, then they would front. And then while the ball was in the air to the fronted Porzingis, bring help over it. And it got to the point where they were doubling Porzingis much of the time, 18 feet away from the basket, just hard doubles. And that was a strategy that I actually advocated for to some degree, because Porzingis has one of the lowest assist rates, might be the lowest assist rate, basically, of anyone who's ever scored 25 or more per game when we looked at it a couple weeks ago. I don't know how much that's changed. And in fact, Porzingis had one assist, although he did have a few more hockey assists in this one. But it was very interesting to see that that's the strategy they went to, and I thought it was a decent one given the lack of shooting that the Knicks have with Tim Hardaway Jr. out of the lineup with that stress reaction.
I mean, they're starting Jarrett Jack, Lance Thomas, and Courtney Lee. Courtney Lee was still having a nice season. They're starting those guys on the perimeter, and Enes Kanter, you know, he could space the floor better than most centers, but you think about just there aren't as many guys there that can just absolutely make you pay if you're forcing the ball out of Porzingis's hands. And part of the other reason I enjoyed this game was because a lot of players had good offensive performances. You know, not everybody had the best defensive performances in this game. There were definitely some defense optional moments, but one of those was Lonzo Ball. He had a really nice stretch. I believe it was in the third quarter where he hit two threes.
You can ask LeVar when that was, because he was just going completely crazy in his front row seats. MSG never disappoints with giving certain people front row seats, as Frank Isolo could tell you. But he went pretty crazy celebrating like a couple of Lonzo plays in a row.
And of course, he was wearing a shirt that made it very hard to recognize that he was the one who was in fact standing up, even though we would have known anyway. But yeah, Lonzo had some really nice stretches in this game. He had that alley-oop dunk from KCP, which was another nice play. He had some good defense possessions. And of course, he's a phenomenal passer. So something Kevin Pelton brought up, not the original KP, because the original KP is even before Kevin Pelton, but that Lonzo looks so much better when he's aggressive and when he's confident, and he looked aggressive and confident for stretches of this game, and it was a reminder of, yeah, this guy's a really good basketball player. He just needs to figure out the elements of his game, i.e. shooting, that are weak.
Yeah, I mean, when he hits a couple of threes, he really does get a lot more verve in his step, and he starts getting back to the confident player that we have come to expect. And we saw a few of the hit-ahead passes. He had a couple right at the end of the first half. Ball's line in aggregate, 6 of 13, hit 3 out of 6 on three-pointers for 17 points, 6 assists, 8 rebounds. He did have a few plays that... I did not like. He is very susceptible, especially immediately after a switch, to giving up back cuts. We saw the Warriors kill him on that. McDermott burned him a couple of times in this game. And then he also just goes for a bunch of offensive rebounds that he just has no chance at. And there were three times in this game where he went for offensive rebounds, or like went for the steal after a defensive rebound by the Knicks. And as a result, the guy who was guarding a point guard would get ahead of him, the big guarding Porzingis would have to go and help out, and then they would end up getting a three for Porzingis. And so that definitely hurt. You know, I think he's just got to learn to pick his spots a little bit better with that. What else stuck out to you about this one, Danny?
We're too early for my tirade on the end of regulation, right?
Yes, we are. We're going for the generalist theme right now. But I could talk about Brandon Ingram. 5 points, 2 of 12, 5 assists, 5 turnovers. Really just a nightmare game for him. Only took 1 3-point attempt. He definitely is not even close to comfortable pulling up from 3 off the dribble. And he goes right every time. Draymond Green actually talked about that when he discussed his contest of him late in regulation in that Warriors game. And to the point where the Knicks strategy actually was to force him to go left, even if he was doing a pick and roll on the right side of the floor. You won't see that usually. You'll force a guy baseline in that situation. And many times he would try to go right when it wasn't really there from the right wing. And then he's also, when he, even if he can kind of get a shoulder by guys, he's not strong enough to stay on his path. So he'll kind of get bumped off of it. And then he would just be careening into the baseline and have to throw just a terrible pass that got picked off. Those were many of his 5 turnovers. And especially when he's just not looking to shoot the jump shot, it becomes very difficult for him. I thought he played a solid game defensively. He, when he got switched on to KP, I thought he did a solid job, even blocked his shot one time, but really an ugly game from Ingram. And, you know, again, he's falling into the same category as a lot of these guys. He certainly made significant improvements from last year, but, you know, as with all the young players, you hear the games that they do well and you don't hear about the games where they don't do well. And this was certainly one that fell into that category.
It was good to see Frank Ntilikina out there so much. He ended up partially due to overtime playing 29 minutes, which was actually more than Jarrett Jack. He still has good chemistry with Kristaps Porzingis, and he was a little bit more aggressive at getting a shot. He still, I wouldn't say that he's necessarily looking for it. It's more when it falls into his lap, he'll take it. But I have liked him more as a passer, and of course he has a lot of defensive potential. And I think the Knicks, they just play with a little bit of a different energy during his minutes. And he hasn't figured it all out yet, but I think they're better for it when he's out there.
Yeah, and Frank continues to show great vision finding the role, man. I mean, I've watched probably his 2 best games of the year. I think his other one was against Charlotte. And the chemistry in the pick and roll with Porzingis when they're not actually switching. Now, Ntilikina has zero chance of beating anybody on a switch. And one play that was telling, although he shot the ball well today, was Lonzo actually just miscommunicated and opened up a straight patch to the rim. He didn't take it. Then he faked out Lonzo and finally did go to the rim and just was not even thinking about going in for what appeared to be an open layup. I mean, he passed the ball, you know, basically from the free throw line a million miles an hour trying to find someone cutting in from the corner, and I think he ended up turning it over. So he really is just, at any time when he gets inside the arc, he also shot a 2-point jumper in overtime that looked terrible when they were up. So he's got to get much better. But considering his age, I mean, I think he's been solid in the 3-point shooting. He hasn't been shooting well overall, but he looks like he can be at least a little bit of a threat. He hit one super deep one as the shot clock was winding down. What did you see from Kyle Kuzma in this one?
He was certainly aggressive looking for his shot. I mean, he was, there were moments where he just really went for it and taking 11 shots inside the arc, including, I think it was 2 dunks, something like that. It was good. I mean, you want to see a more balanced game from him in that way. Still not great defensively, but it ties in. I mean, there are a couple of strands on.
I thought he actually did okay in isolation against Porzingis. I thought he did a good job.
He did better than I expected at the bare minimum.
Yeah, and it wasn't that efficient of a game for me. He doesn't really get to the foul line very much. He had 19 points, 8 out of 17, 3 of 6 on threes. But I was very impressed too, just with like some of the plays that they'll run for him. I mean, they're running plays with him where he'll like flare off a screen away from the ball and get a pass and just, you know, shoot a jump shot on a catch and shoot with his footwork. I mean, he almost looks like a 2-guard out there sometimes with his jump shot.
And something that you and I have discussed at various moments, and I believe you were on this before I was, so full credit to you, is that the starting lineup needs his offense. I mean, they're already playing Lonzo Ball and Brandon Ingram, 2 guys that have noted deficiencies as 3-point shooters. And Brook Lopez, you know, he is what he is, and he can shoot threes, but that's not what he is. And so Kuzma would just bring more there than Larry Nance, and their defense has been better than we anticipated, certainly. But they are not playing. I mean, you can make an argument, and we certainly have have in the past, and you more than me, that they should also play Jordan Clarkson more than Lonzo Ball. But at the bare minimum, I mean, Kuzma, it's a different calculus because he's a more likely piece of their future than Larry Nance is, as opposed to the Ball-Clarkson one, which is more clear the other way.
Yeah, and when you've got Ball out there shooting as poorly as he is, when he actually was on today, it looks much better. But that starting lineup with Nance as well, I mean, you've got three guys, Ingram, Ball, and Nance, who just are not threats at all behind the arc, and you're just relying on KCP. KCP actually got up 14 three-point attempts in this one. It was good to see the Lakers actually get up 35 threes, although against this Knicks defense that plays two bigs together most of the time, that's a little bit easier to do. And Walton, he goes back to his starting lineup at the end of the second, but he knows that that's not the best lineup at the end of the fourth quarter. And in large part, the lineups were very interesting down the stretch. It was Ntilikina, Courtney Lee, Doug McDermott, Michael Beasley, who had a nice stretch early in the fourth quarter, attacking some switches by the Lakers, and then Porzingis at center. And that unit forced a bunch of turnovers from the Lakers. And it was really, I thought, two fun small groups out there at the end, despite the fact that there were some rather interesting strategic decisions in this one.
Yeah, and it was fun to see Michael Beasley have some nice moments. And then actually, McDermott, you talked about a little bit earlier, but I think it warrants repeating. McDermott had some beautiful duck-ins and just effort plays in overtime. He also had one of those, I think of it as a coach's son play, which McDermott is a coach's son, where he grabbed Lonzo Ball when Ball was going for a rebound, and they're never going to call that in overtime. They should. You know, it's certainly a foul, but he did that, and that's how the Knicks got an extra possession, which I believe McDermott scored on.
Yeah, they ran in the OT the same play either three or four times in a row. It was actually something out of Terry Stotts' playbook, where they would have McDermott start on the left side of the floor, curl off to the right elbow where Porzingis was waiting, and Porzingis would set a flare screen. So McDermott, if you go under that, he has the option to pop back out and shoot a three. Or if you stay attached to him from behind, you've got Porzingis, a great shooter. His man doesn't want to help on the back screen, and so McDermott's able to curl right to the rim. And they were late on both of the passes to him. One of them, he ended up missing the layup, but I think they got the offensive board. Another one, he was able to convert the layup. He had a smaller guy on him most of the time. And then the last time the Knicks finally defended it, but really it was more just that the timing was, or the Lakers finally defended it, but it looks like the timing from the Knicks, it was up. But it was good by, I like to see Hornacek just go back to the same play over and over again. And with Porzingis setting that screen and a shooter like McDermott, who's also a smart cutter, he really hurt the Knicks quite a bit. Jeez, I keep conflating those. He really hurt the Lakers quite a bit in this one. With those back cuts, it could be a very effective set for the Knicks.
So the two coaching fiascos were at the end of regulation and the end of overtime. So at the end of regulation, the Lakers had a foul to give, and the Knicks knew that, and the Knicks got the ball after Kyle Kuzma hit a big three to tie the game at 99. And so basically the question just became, okay, what are the Knicks going to do? And they knew they had the foul to give. So the way that generally works is a team goes a little earlier, they get the foul at, I don't know, like 10 seconds or something like that, and then they do whatever the play was intentionally. This time, you could say it's two young teams. You could also say it was two young teams that might not have been prepared for this for some reason. The Knicks went way too late, and actually, my feeling was they got bailed out by the Lakers fouling because they got to about 5 seconds and had no idea what the hell they were going to do. Porzingis had the ball by himself at the top of the key. Julius Randle was on him, and Julius Randle just fouled him. Like, if they hadn't fouled, I think they would have just thrown up some crap, but the Knicks ended up basically throwing up some crap anyway. They had the chance, you know, with 4 seconds left to do something, and they didn't there. So, actually, let's talk about that one, then we can talk about the other one.
Yeah, well, so for Porzingis, I mean, the play was the Lakers switched everything. They had Porzingis going to the top of the key, and KCP did a nice job of switching on to Porzingis. And Porzingis, for all of his gifts, he really, unless you get him the ball with a live dribble within about 20 feet of the basket, he's really not going to be able to create separation and get a shot unless he's just against like a really slow traditional center. And you can, once he puts the ball on the floor, you can send a double. As we mentioned, he's not really the greatest passer in the world. And so he had no chance to like get a good shot off against KCP that far away from the rim. Actually, I thought the worst play, and you know, that wasn't a huge one. I mean, you're you've got a chance to come back, but you're a lot of times not going to get a great shot when you have to run the time down there. The play that killed me the most was Knicks up three, 35 seconds left. Porzingis goes in for a layup and misses it, thinks he gets fouled, and stops to scream at the ref up three with 35 seconds left. And they end up, it was his man, Kuzma, I believe. Or, I mean, you know, you can never quite assign responsibility to a certain man because it's, you know, your transition defense has to cover the gaps and you end up on someone maybe you're not initially assigned to. But they give up a three with Porzingis way behind the play. I mean, if there's ever a time to just get back and not bitch while the ball is in play, I mean, that's it. I mean, that's really just like, and nothing bothers me more than seeing that, especially in like a critical time of the game like that. Like, just get over yourself and get back on defense, man.
Yeah, and if they had even slowed the Lakers down on that possession, maybe they don't get a three, maybe they don't get as good of a three as they ended up with, and they have a much better chance of just winning the game in regulation. And then overtime was the one that really got me, because it's just such a basic process thing. I agree with you that, you know, that's
well, you want to know how basic it was? Mark Jackson was yelling that they were making a huge mistake.
That's true.
And he was actually right.
Completely right. So the Knicks were up, they were actually up before this, they were up six, and then they fouled KCP. KCP made two free throws. So they have the ball, and then it ends up being that McDermott turns it over and KCP shoots a three and misses it. So the Knicks have the ball up 4 points with 32 seconds to go. And so you're sitting there going, oh, well, the Lakers need two possessions. They have to make this game include as many possessions as they can. And so you're sitting there and they're like, they're not fouling. And so they're not fouling at all. And eventually Frank Ntilikina misses a shot. They get the rebound, and then they, amazingly enough, they go quick too. They go for a two, and everything happens. But it's like, you basically are committing yourself to failing by going for by not fouling there, because you, if as long as the team waits out the clock, they're gonna shoot it with, like, you know, somewhere between 8 to 10 seconds left. Then the time the ball is in the air and all that. And then what made it even more egregious was the Lakers hadn't even used their foul to give. So then even when they had the favorable outcome, when KCP got the tip in on Kuzma's miss, they still couldn't basically even, they couldn't have even made their way back in the game. Yeah. It was absolutely insanely bad tactical management from Luke Walton and execution from the team. You don't know exactly who messed up, but it seems like everyone messed up.
Yeah. Now, keep in mind here, I agree with you, it didn't make any sense to me, but keep in mind here that if you're down four and the other team has the ball with 32 seconds left, your win probability is probably, you know, like 3% or something. So you're 5%. So it's not like, didn't cost them that much of a chance, but yeah, I found it.
Yeah, but it's basically lowering it to zero for no good reason. Like, that, you know, right. It's not the margin that's the issue. It's the reason for it. So yeah, it's, you know, and the Lakers winning or losing this game is not going to affect the arc of their season or anything like that. But I always look at those. I mean, we've talked about this with Brett Brown before this year, where you don't get that many chances when you have a young team that isn't as good talent wise to prove your metal in clutch games. And this was a concern with Luke Walton in judgment, just like the concerns that he's playing the wrong guys and all that. I mean, you have all these things that are kind of running together, and that's, you know, I'm not making any bold pronouncements here to say like, oh, he's a bad coach, oh, he should be fired or anything silly like that. But you do start to file these things away, and you consider them for when you have more information.
Yeah. Well, the other thing you need to file away though is that, like, their defense is actually solid this year.
Right.
Their personnel, you know, I mean, and that's absolutely, and that's much bigger than any of this lineup stuff or anything else. And I think,
right,
you know, especially with him trying to build a culture, you know, you understand maybe why it is that Larry Nance is going to start, and Brooke Lopez is an established veteran. Like, if you're going to not play him in crunch time and you're not going to start him, you're just going to lose him completely. So it makes sense to me. And he's had a very disappointing year, I think, as well. But, you know, had Kuzma and Randall not emerged this year, he would be playing more in the clutch. But I think Randall and Kuzma, especially with their additional versatility defensively, look a little bit better than Lopez at the end of the game. So I think, like, Luke has done overall a good job getting this team to defend is good, but, you know, there are some things at the margin they could do to get more offense. Last thing on this game, Kristaps Porzingis. I mean, you've discussed on the 15 15 and 16 at other times. His absolutely insane field goal percentage allowed on shots at the rim, it's like under 40%. He is just impossible to score on when he's in position. Like, if he's around, you're just not going to score. Like, and you know, his mobility is a little bit limited. Maybe he's not going to get there, but if he's even remotely between you and the basket and you're going to try and go up for a shot within 5 feet of the rim, you're just not going to score.
It's incredible. I still vacillate on what his ideal kind of position and role is overall, just because of the practical matter of, you know, you can't really have a guy be a center on one end, power forward on the other end, or vice versa. It's just, you know, who's next to him. But that value as a rim protector is intense, and I want to see where it goes. And I have a strange feeling that might come up later in this week for a podcast that we're going to do on best young players in the league.
Yeah, just so we have it, by the way, thanks to Cleaning the Glass for this one. The Knicks, in the 9% of minutes that KP has played at center, plus 13.4 net rating, plus 3.5 net rating still when he's at power forward. And also when you consider, and they've closed a few games with him at center, and I think have been effective there. So I think we'll see more of that. But given their limited wing depth, especially with Hardaway out right now, probably not realistic to play him that much at center during the meat of the game. So I understand that. And, you know, they've got all these centers that they have to keep happy. So I think closing with him at center, but keeping him at power forward most of the time, especially because that's what he wants to do too, is play power forward. He feels like it wears him down. So
I will crack up that you say they have all these centers they need to keep happy, but Willy Hernangómez keeps getting DNPs.
Well, and Noah is like not even dressing either. I mean, that's like, he's just sitting behind the bench. I mean, I wonder if he's ever even going to play another minute for the Knicks.
I think he will. Maybe he'll play a few more minutes for the Westchester Knicks.
Well, or maybe he'll, play during like the last Twitter NBA show of the season when they're in like super tank mode at the end of the year. Although, you know, they could be, they might get a pick that's
actually
a little higher than one.
There's a very short thing I wanted to talk about before we get into the last game, which is this dynamic that, just because of the games we've covered, we haven't really mentioned, but a lot of the teams that are at the bottom of the, you know, not only the win column so far this year, but the projected win column at the end of the year, have really picked some up in the last. I mean, you have the Unbeatables now that have won three straight. The Kings have won a couple games recently. The Suns are probably going to fall off. They lost to the Kings today without Devin Booker. So, like, it's getting, you know, those teams are pushing up. Right now, the Bulls and Hawks are tied for the bottom with six wins, I believe. And then, you know, everybody else is 9, 8, 9, 10, 11. And so the bottom might be a little higher this year than we thought it might have been.
Yeah, the Bulls actually getting some nice play out of Chris Dunn. Mirotić has returned. By the way, that was one of the funnier tweets in a while when you tweeted out that screenshot. Was that a real screenshot of 1-2 punch?
I believe that was the CSN on the after the Bulls broadcast. And I mean,
oh, that's great.
The sheer gumption of pulling that.
Whoever it was, just like, they just had decided before the game, like, hey, we're gonna run this graphic with whoever the two best players were, and it ended up being those.
Oh, see, I think it was the reverse. I think they went, we're gonna do it live, and we're just gonna throw it out there. And they thought,
no,
they
probably, no way. I don't know. Anybody who works for like one of those CSN units, and it's kind of like half owned by the team, like, they are way too scared to do something like that on purpose. Yeah, Chris Haynes back when he worked for,
whoever has the insight on this, you can send it to us in the DMs. We'll keep it anonymous, but I would love to know.
Yeah, Chris Haynes back when he worked for, and Vince Goodwill is in this category too, actually, of guys who work for the local CSN or NBC's local sports now channel are the guys who are willing to buck a little bit, and I respect them a lot from that. But I certainly understand why, when you're basically employed by the team or by a network that the team owns, like, you know, 25 or 50% of, why you might be a little more cautious there. All right, let's get to a read here. Holiday shopping can be tough, but thanks to Movement Watches, mvmt.com/capspace is your URL to get started with them. You can make your Christmas shopping a very easy proposition. My mom actually likes the watches so much that she actually got another one for my brother's girlfriend this year, and she's previously gotten some for my cousins, her nieces. I got her one. She used the CapSpace code. She was very happy to say that she did that yesterday, or I said the /CapSpace URL, I should say, on that. And if you just go to that URL, mvmt.com, movement.com/CapSpace, you'll see why. It's a beautiful styled minimalism. I happen to like their 40 series for men, but men's and women's watches. You'll find something you like, and you'll find it starting at just $95. And then you get that 15% off with that /CapSpace URL as well. They've now sold over a million watches, and they've sold in over 160 countries. So if you're an international listener wanting to support the show, this is a great way to do that. Once again, to get started with them, movement.com, mvmt.com/capspace. Join the movement and let them know that you came from us with that /capspace URL. All right, Danny, this was in many ways, Philly and Minnesota, an ugly game. And, you know, last year we were really excited to see Towns versus Embiid. And I guess where I want to start with this a little bit is just that it seems like some of the joy of watching Karl Towns has kind of been lost, even on the offensive end so far this year. Like, he's not really taking as many threes. He's seems to be like second in the pecking order, maybe third as well, despite being a really efficient player. His usage is down. I mean, he took 16 shots tonight, and Wiggins took 24, and Butler took 33. And it just, we were at a point with Towns, this is something we'll talk more about on the prospects, I'm sure. I mean, still a wonderful player, very skilled, where just anything seemed possible with this guy. And we're just, it seems like now it's kind of, he's settled into just sort of being a cog in this Tibbs machine, a cog that will probably soon break due to the minutes that he's playing. And a lot of the joy kind of seems lost in watching Karl Towns to me this year.
This Minnesota team is not hard to figure out. It's just hard to process. And I've been dealing with this over the course of the year where it's a lot of players that I enjoy, but I don't necessarily enjoy them together.
Yes.
And Towns is more a victim of this actually than Jimmy Butler is. I mean, we talked about how Jimmy Butler earlier in the year, you know, it seemed like he had to find himself and everything like that, and he's been getting better. I'd say he's been having a nice go of it. Had another monster of a statistical game here, but I mean, this was his third game of 30 or more points in the last six, and it might have been the last five actually. And he's kind of getting his stride. Towns, it's just going to be harder for him because Butler is the alpha in a lot of ways, and the problem is not necessarily that Towns is even the second fiddle. It's that he's fighting for second fiddle with Andrew Wiggins, who thinks he is a more important player in this offense than he should be, and that's a big problem. And
yeah, so well, you know, for Wiggins, his usage is actually down. I think like 22% usage is not crazy for him. It's just that it's so many jumpers with him. It's so many long twos. He doesn't have the craft to get to the basket. He's not a great passer. He's not a great cutter. And I think he's the guy who suffered the most from kind of this spacing challenge to team, even though obviously, you know, Taj Gibson is clearly their best power forward on the roster. But I think it's Wiggins, you know, Towns and Butler are so good that they can just score pretty efficiently, even with all the limitations that they have around them. And even Teague, to some extent, too, is a guy who can get to the foul line every once in a while, get into floater range. He's not as reliant on the spacing. But Wiggins, to me, is the guy who is struggling the most because all he really has is one dribble pull up for a long two, come off the screen for a long two, take and likely miss a spot up three. Who's 1 of 7 tonight.
It's something that I thought of during this game, particularly in overtime, because there were a couple of absolutely heinous possessions, was we over the years have pinpointed that bad defenders are a lot better in post-ups in particular, and sometimes in one-on-one circumstances because they can just lock in on their guy. They don't have to do anything else, and that they get exploited everywhere else. And we saw a lot of that with Karl Towns in this game. Towns did a nice job on Joel Embiid a fair portion of the time when it was one-on-one, when he just kind of like, okay, this is my guy, not biting on pump fakes, not biting on feints, and just making a hard shot. Didn't block it every time, didn't get everything, but he did a good job there. But then when it was in the open court, when he had to deal with one of the linchpins of this game was both he and Wiggins missing Ben Simmons cutting at the same time. Simmons got an easy dunk.
Yeah, well, that wasn't Towns' fault though. Like, that was just Wiggins. Like, I remember you tweeted about the play and I caught up on it and I was like, oh, this is the play. But like, I mean, there wasn't a screen there. Like, Wiggins was just standing on the other side of the floor, as was Simmons, and Simmons just ran right into the basket and Wiggins didn't follow him. Like, that's not Towns' responsibility. If Towns is manned instead of screen, I see it, and maybe, you know, he could have some awareness to provide some emergency help, but that's all Wiggins to me on that play.
That's fair, but I mean, it wasn't the only moment in that game where Towns on the cut or in something.
No,
like
obviously
that.
It's been well documented, you know, I mean, his defense on like that Embiid Euro step where he was operating more as a help defender, I thought, for example, was pretty heinous, where, you know, Embiid picks the ball up at like the free throw line, basically, and Towns like starts jumping like he's gonna shoot a floater from the free throw line, and Embiid like euro steps right by him.
And then you compare that to what Philadelphia has, and remember, they weren't playing Robert Covington this game because he's still out with his back issue, that their players seem like they amplify each other. And part of that is because they're all three of them are capable passers. I mean, Simmons is obviously the best passer of the six, and Towns is a wonderful passer, but it ties in there. And because the floor spacing is better, the defense is miles better. And, you know, I mean, Jimmy Butler is still a phenomenal player. I don't blame him for this at all. But when you think about those collectives, and then you think about just kind of how the teams are built on top of that, JJ Redick is so much more of a coherent piece with what Philly is building. And yes, he is only on a 1-year contract, so we don't know how that's going to happen moving forward.
And by the way, I mean, how much better would the Wolves look right now if they'd thrown their money at him, maybe? I mean, well, I don't know. I mean, it's tough to say whether they're getting more out of Gibson and Teague than they might have out of Redick. But they, you know, what they could have done maybe too would be they could have gotten Redick for less money on a 2-year deal or something like that. You know, maybe because he talked about on his podcast how he was hoping for a longer term deal just to get a little bit more kind of stability and security than the 1-year deal. But if they offer him, you know, 2 years, $32 million or something like that, like, does he come there instead of going to Philly for 1 year, $23 million? Maybe he does.
And you have that with the Wolves that, I mean, they only had one made three-pointer in the first 47 minutes of this game. And they will make more of those. You know, it was that they had some bad luck and had some bad misses in that time. But they are going to have games like that. They are not so good as shooters that you go, oh my God, that's never going to happen or anything like that. And they also, you know, like, they get to the free throw line to their credit. They got, it's been the early part of the game, they were getting to the line more, that waned late. And so they are going to, you know, they'll have good games, they'll have bad games. But remember, they weren't getting Philly's best shot. Ben Simmons couldn't score throughout most of this game. He was missing some shots he wasn't taking. I think he only had 4 shots for a lot of it.
Yeah, he's had a few games where he just, especially against teams with real good rim protection, I think, where he just doesn't feel comfortable trying to go right to the rim. But so, I mean, that's one thing to watch about his game is, like, you know, can he score against the best teams? Not that this is some great Minnesota defense, but he'll have some oddly passive games. But
the other part of that is that they really missed Covington because the guy they started in his stead was Rashawn Holmes. And while Rashawn Holmes actually took 3 threes, you respect him in a very different way than Covington. And I just thought that put more guys in Ben Simmons' path, and that was a part of what scared him off. And so it's not necessarily even about the quality of an individual defender, just the overall amount of arms and bodies and all that kind of stuff was a problem for him. And he was able to contribute in other ways, had a couple of beautiful passes, including just a beaut of an alley-oop to Rashawn Holmes, basically from half court. He can do that. And Šarić is also a wonderful passer. He had I think it was to Simmons, actually. He had a really nice one in overtime. And so that's a concern for this T-Wolves team, is that if their defense isn't consistent and isn't good, their offense is going to sputter. Like, they're going to have games like that, absolutely. And they're also going to have games when they sputter late because they play their guys an absolutely heinous amount of minutes.
Yeah, with the Wolves, I mean, and we've talked about that a lot. I don't think we need to get into it too much, but Towns, 48 minutes, Butler, 46 in this one. No Sixer played more than 40, despite the overtime. Embiid had 39. I would imagine that's a career high in minutes for him. But the Sixers, you know, you mentioned the lack of spacing. I mean, they had 24 turnovers, and with a young team, especially now without as much spacing, you'll see that. And Booker was good. Trevor Booker was good. You know, and we were a little critical of that trade. I mean, he had 12 points and 5 assists on 6 of 8 and was plus 8 in this one. But, and he played more than Amir Johnson did, pretty much exclusively in 2 big alignments. But when you see that, you know, TLC only played 4 minutes, they've got McConnell, another non-shooter who, again, you know, is a solid player, but brings a ton of fit issues. Getting one more guy who could shoot on the wing and just, you know, not make bad mistakes defensively, I thought was a bigger need than what they're getting with Booker. Another thing that was huge to me about this one that stuck out more than just about anything was Joel Embiid's passing. 8 assists. He was getting doubled late. I mean, he had one pass. He had, the Sixers were down 9 with 6 minutes left in regulation. And Embiid, I think, had either 3 or 4 assists in that last 6 minutes of the game. One where he drove in from the right wing, late clock, got double teamed, and leaned backward, reached around with his left hand to throw a pass to a wide open shooter. And he hit a couple of cutters as well. He was getting double teamed, finding people. And the growth in his game since that first Golden State game, shortly thereafter, was that Lakers game where he had a ton of assists. I mean, that is just so massive to me that he's become a quality passer in just this short amount of time, especially when you consider the lack of spacing, that some of the windows that he had to get into there. And he only had two turnovers as well. He was not the big problem with their turnover issues.
He still is a little bit prone to the over dribbling and some of the concerns we had last year and early this year, but it even seems like he's taking steps to make that better. And Derek Bodner and I have talked over the last couple of years about one of the defining attributes of Joel Embiid is how much better he can get during like a small period of time.
Yeah, we've and talked about that too. I mean, it's really remarkable.
It's insane. And the fact that he still has played, I think it's somewhere around 50 NBA games, and has been able to improve as much as he has and be as good defensively as he has been overall, and the fact that he played all of overtime with five fouls, that's also, you know, then he needed to stay on the floor. There was one play where he almost committed his sixth, but they called it on Rashawn Holmes before he committed his sixth. But outside of that, I thought he did a good job avoiding it, and he is just an incredible talent. And the Sixers are not close to a finished product. They probably won't be for a long time, but they have some really, really good pieces to build around. And what I love so much about Simmons Embiid Covington is that you can do a lot of different things as long as it involves shooting, and I think it's going to work. You don't have to get exactly the right guy, you just have to fit certain boxes.
Couple more notes on this one before we retire from the evening. JJ Redick, 11 of 11 from the foul line, 26 points. And when you foul JJ Redick for 11 free throw attempts in a game, you are not playing good defense. That is just, you are fouling a jump shooter time and again. He's not getting to the rim, he's not putting pressure on the defense in that way. Jeff Teague had a really bad foul on him during their comeback, and that was a disappointment. And then Minnesota, well, they did get on the offensive glass for 17 offensive rebounds, including a big one that led to a big three by Butler with under a minute remaining. Actually, like three offensive rebounds in a row that finally led to that Butler three. Their transition defense is so bad. I mean, if you're asking guys to get on the offensive glass with two traditional bigs and get back and play this number of minutes, it's really just completely unrealistic. Again, the Wolves went to only three subs. They still have that mid-foot sprain with Bielica, so he's out. And, you know, Shabazz Muhammad's not playing. Cole Aldridge, I don't know if he's even played a minute this year. So it's basically Jang, Tyus Jones, and Jamal Crawford. And Gibson fouled out at the beginning of overtime, or he would have played 45 minutes, and Jang would have played 13. I really think you could alleviate things a little bit by playing Jones and Teague more together, or something along those lines. But, you know, we'll see what ends up happening here. Tibbs has not learned his lesson, apparently. And it's always, you always have plausible deniability in these issues, right? Like, you can never prove that it's the minutes that cause problems. But, you know, I think generally it's been shown at this point that teams that play players this number of minutes eventually are more likely in the long run to suffer additional injuries.
You knew I was going to look it up. Cole Aldridge has played 10 minutes this year.
That's a great one to end on.
And his played, well, no, I wanted to mention one other thing. And 531 last year was that Tibbs went, to his credit, because you and I both support this, he went no timeout at the end of regulation.
Yes.
So that Philly couldn't get into it. And credit to Dario Saric for a nice contest on Jimmy Butler's shot. I think he slipped a little bit, and so they couldn't get exactly what they wanted. But I like the process of it. It didn't work out for them. He missed the shot. They ended up going to overtime and losing. But I like that he made that decision.
Yeah, and that's interesting. And also Tibbs is a big timeout guy. They actually had a timeout left too. You know, he usually would call it, and it was after Embiid hit two free throws to tie it. They ran a great play for Embiid before that down two, where Simmons inbounded it to Embiid, who just beasted Karl Towns, turned around right at the charge circle, got it, and got a foul call, and Embiid hit two clutch free throws, finished 11 of 12 from the foul line on his way to those 28 points. And then the no timeout isn't quite as effective when the other team has had a chance to sub as with a free throw, and, you know, you kind of have 60 seconds to talk things over and get things in your head as well. But I still appreciated it, and especially if you're going to run the time down and run an ISO anyway, as they did, But the other downside there is he didn't quite get the type of play I would have liked, because they had Butler on the right wing. Jeff Teague, guarded by Redick, is in the right corner. If you're going to do an ISO on the wing, you really got to clear that corner out and go to the weak side, or you need to just do the ISO from the top of the key. This is another one that Steph Curry kills me on too, where he always tries to ISO, you know, like below the break. And it's like, if you can't back up and get some speed up, because, like, you know, Butler had an advantage matchup against Šarić, you would think. So Šarić played good D, and Butler stumbled and ended up way short on the shot after he'd previously hit 2 3-pointers in the last minute, including a 6 step back on Embiid after a switch and pick and roll.
One other thing I just wanted to mention, because it's a strength of his that we don't talk about enough, Embiid is shooting 80% at the free throw line for the season, and 79% for his career.
All right, that is a good one to end on. Don't forget our sponsors, Movement Watches, MVMT.com/capspace is that URL. And don't forget about the Twitter NBA show. Tomorrow, we've got Paul George's non-triumphant return to Indy, at least as it stands right now. No one would have ever predicted that the Pacers would have a better record than OKC during this game, especially when you consider the lack of injuries so far that OKC has sustained. So that'll be a really interesting one. I'm really looking forward to getting into the Pacers in the usual granular detail that we always provide. And then, you know, we'll do the first quarter of Hornets Rockets until that turns into a blowout.
Hey, maybe Dwight will have another great game against a former team. He's already done it at least once this year, I think twice.
All right, talk to you all next time.